Welcome to A Closer Look, a special KSKA presentation. I'm Beatty Trantina. A Closer Look gives listeners a chance to learn more about a recent news story or to profile in depth the people who affect our community. The Social Security Administrative Appeals process represents one of the largest judicial systems in the world. Most of the millions of disability benefit claims filed annually are decided at the state level. But about 750,000 claims are heard by an administrative law judge. That process has dragged for Alaskans who had filed appeals because cases had to wait until a Seattle-based judge could travel to our state. But on February 19th, all that changed when Social Security Commissioner Michael Astrew visited Anchorage to open up Alaska's first disability hearing office. Commissioner Astrew also visited our studios and spoke to KSKA's Ellen Lockyer about changes in our Social Security program aimed at keeping it in step with our country's changing demographics.
Hello, welcome to Alaska.
Thank you.
Let's go with the first question. Why are you here?
I'm here. We're opening up the first hearing office in Alaska for Social Security. We have about 1,200 people a year who file appeals on disability decisions. And up until this week, the process had been we rotated judges up through Seattle, which was caused long delays and we'll get much prompter service for the people of Alaska actually having a functioning hearing office here. So we should be able to cut the time down to almost 2 years in Alaska, too. We're hoping that it'll be right for our target of about 270 days.
So can you describe what a hearing office does?
Sure. We run what's generally described as the largest system of justice in the world. So we take in, this year it'll be about 3.35 million claims for disability benefits. And there's a two-level process in the states. Most of the cases get decided at that level. But there are about 750,000 that are appealed up to a formal hearing before an administrative law judge. And it's the first face-to-face meeting. And a number of people do that. And we've had backups around the country. And we've been slow over the last 25 years to really expand the infrastructure to match the demographic changes in the country. So this is doubly exciting for me. I mean, this is a great thing for Alaska, but it's a great thing for the country because this is the first of the 25 new offices that are going to be opened in the next 18 months or so. So for us, it's very exciting that this is the start of a historic expansion.
So is this decision to expand the disability offices, if you will, is this prompted by complaints or is it prompted by the rush of baby boomers to Social Security?
No, it's huge complaint. I came in early 2007 just as it hit a peak with the media and the Congress. So it was a difficult place to start. And we'd been falling behind at about 70,000 cases a year nationally to the point where we had 750,000 people waiting for a decision. And when I started, we had people who were waiting 4 years. So we've reduced the average processing time. We've reduced the number of cases pending. It took us a little less than 2 years to hit the tipping point. We've gone down 15 straight months, but we've also put caps on the oldest cases. So 3 years ago, our oldest cases were 1,400 days. Today, it's 825 days. That's not acceptable, but it's moving in the right direction, and it will continue to move aggressively in the right direction the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. 800 days, that's a lot. So who are these people who file disability claims?
It's an eclectic mix. When the program started in 1957, it was really conceptualized for demographically people that look like me. Middle-aged males, blue-collar jobs, and typically people that threw out a back lifting a box or those kinds of sort of blue-collar injuries. And it was conceptualized as basically a fairly small form of early retirement. Our definition of disability has expanded enormously since that time. So we have a lot of children's cases. We see a lot of psychiatric cases. We see a dizzying array of and combinations of diseases and conditions and things like that. So it's an extraordinarily diverse group these days.
Yeah. And is there, what are the parameters? Say, I'm a little naive about Social
Sure.
Security, although I'm heading in that direction myself. If a person does not have to be on Social Security to file a disability claim, a person has to be
related. That's right. So I'll try to, we tend to slip into jargon quickly when we explain this, but basically you need to be covered. You need to have paid a minimum amount into the system. Most adults fall into that category. Most children of adults that have, are in their 20s even fall into that category. Most people are covered these days. There's a limited number of people who are not. And then the standard, while it's a little bit more complicated than this, the quick way to explain it is if we believe on the basis of your work history and your medical condition that you're not likely to be able to work in the next 12 months, then we put you on disability.
So you were mentioning earlier, sir, that the concept was pretty much directed at middle-aged white males.
Originally, in 1957.
And, of course,
right.
We keep pushing out the parameters of the mental disabilities, diabetes, FASD.
Right.
So how has that – are you saying that the system needs an overhaul or –
No, I'm not saying that at all. In some sense, it's a positive thing that the people we're serving look like America now, and the whole range of gender and race and age level and that type of thing. Is the system perfect? No. There are, I'm sure, a number of things that we need to be thinking about doing. One of the things that we got away from with the budget reductions for most of the last 15 years is in order to maintain the integrity of the system, we periodically re-review cases. And because that's one of our few discretionary activities, that was one of the first things that was thrown overboard. So we're trying to go back and make sure that we re-review cases on a regular and consistent basis to make sure that if we've made a mistake or if there was a significant change in circumstance, so somebody really should be working now, nobody's on the rolls who shouldn't be on the rolls. Because it's a very expensive entitlement. And clearly with all the pressure now on the budget and the president's executive order this week on the debt and talk of entitlement reform generally, I'm sure there will be examination of the program. But in general, it's a program that works very well for most Americans. It's an important part of the safety net. And in terms of generosity, we're similar to where most of the major European nations are, just a smidge less than most of them in terms of the percentage of the working age population that's on disability.
Are there any data on people who are faking disability claims?
There's no hard data. You know, there's a lot of mythology around there. If you listen to people on the internet and that kind of thing, you would think that our roles were just larded with those kind of people. There are some, and the Office of the Inspector General has programs to try to detect those. And those are upsetting when we find them. People should be aware that that's a federal felony to deceive the government in that way. And we do prosecute people who have deliberately deceived the government. But we think it's a relatively small percentage of the cases. We think it's a fraction of 1%. And the argument is, what fraction of 1%?
I am a complete babe in the woods when it comes to Social Security. Are you comfortable getting away from the disability end and
sure.
into the more the nuts and bolts? How about like somebody like me? I'm one of these people. I'm always healthy. I never get sick. I never use my sick leave. And I've never really taken advantage of any of the social systems available or supposedly available to people like me. However, on the rare occasions when I have looked into it, I'm always just or I make just over what you have to, what the cutoff line is to receive any kind of benefit. So what does all this mean for middle-class America? I think people
sure.
my age come from my background pretty much. We grew up in the 40s and the 50s. We're sort of used to hoeing our own row, you know, and we're reluctant.
Yeah,
we're reluctant
sure.
to apply for benefits of any kind.
Right.
What would you say to people who probably don't know they're eligible?
Well, certainly Social Security we all pay in, and we've been paying in more in recent years than we did in the 40s and 50s. And it is an insurance program. It's not a welfare program. And so I don't think anybody should feel philosophically that they shouldn't be applying for any benefits that they're qualified for. I think you're raising exactly the right kinds of questions, because the answer of what to take when is a complicated and difficult one. And it's one that we've worked very hard in the last few years to try to make a little easier for people. I think in the past, both explicitly and implicitly, we had a bias toward telling people to take benefits at the earliest possible time. And we've come around to understanding that that's a real mistake, that there is no average American. Advice based on average American statistics doesn't really tell you very much, and particularly, for instance, for women. Because you're genetically superior, you're likely to live 8 years longer than I live. And that raises the question of the adequacy of your retirement income into your 80s and 90s when we assume that the average American is not here for our actuarial benefit. You're much more likely to be here. Matter of fact, we've got a growing number of centenarians in this country. And so particularly if you're a woman, for instance, you should look very carefully at the decision on the timing of the retirement benefit, because the longer you wait up to the age of 70, the more you get on a monthly basis. And you have to make a very difficult, in essence, actuarial calculation on how long you think you're likely to live. And if you, as you indicated, you're in good health, there's nothing hanging over you in terms of a family genetic legacy that would cause you to question that, then, and you're working and that type of thing, it's probably going to make sense for you to hold off until 70, and you'll be very glad when you're 75, 85, 95, when you're 105 that you did that. But there are other people for whom that's not the right decision. Their health is not good. Some people are in just absolute economic desperation. They do have to take it at the earliest date. One of the things that we offer now that's considered by surveys to be one of the best electronic services in the entire federal government, even better than most corporate electronic services, is our retirement estimator. So you can go to socialsecurity.gov, give us authenticating information, and you can get estimates of your monthly retirement benefit based on your own actual earnings history, and run scenarios and see for yourself, okay, if I wait 2 years, how much will that change my monthly benefit? And I think that's an important thing for people approaching retirement to check. And if they're married, it's very important to have that conversation with the spouse and talk about, you know, joint assumptions and joint plans for retirement.
Hmm. So how would I access that?
SocialSecurity.gov. We have an award-winning website. One of the things I did when I came in is we blew up the old one, which was pretty good. But it is now, we view it as our portal for electronic services. And we have the three best electronic services in the federal government. And I'm bound and determined to have the best five before long. So you can file for retirement online. You can file for disability online. You can file for Medicare Part D, Extra Help, the drug supplement program for low-income people online. And starting March 1, you can apply for Medicare only online. So there are people that are eligible for Medicare at 65 that don't want to take the retirement benefit. They've had to historically either come into an office or do it by telephone. You'll be able to do that online as of next month. And we have a whole new ad campaign at the end of March, starting not only with our spokesperson, Patty Duke, but we've reunited the whole original cast minus one of the original Patty Duke show for some ads that are going to be great fun. So you can look for those. And we found hopefully some amusing ways to tell people that they don't actually have to come into an office for applying for Medicare, and particularly in a state like Alaska, where you've got huge differences and distances and weather and all those kinds of things. The availability of the online services is very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually did it over the phone.
Right.
I got a huge amount of information. Everybody in the world knows I'm turning 65, apparently. And I get all this stuff in the mail. And I finally called the state and asked them for some information. And I did call the 800 number. I had a brief interview over the phone. It was quite easy.
Right.
I deferred Medicare because I'm working and I have insurance. But apparently at 65, I'm eligible for hospitalization should I need it.
Right. Online, I mean, the 800 number is fairly easy for most people. Sometimes we have peak times of demand. Sometimes it's a little hard to get through. We're trying to fix that as best we can. And if you want to talk to a live person, you can always schedule an appointment or you can do it through the 800 line. But increasingly, Americans want to do business with the federal government online. They're used to Amazon. They're used to eBay. They're used to doing their banking online. And they don't want to the inconvenience of it. So adding to the suite of services will be Medicare only. And we've got a lot more coming, including we'll have, we hope by the end of the year, the first Spanish language online services. And those will be the first in the whole federal government. So.
Wow. So. Now, getting back to Alaska, because we are so far flung, that the internet service would be great.
Right.
Do other states have problems? Other rural states with people living in small villages, remote communities who are eligible for Social Security, and is it problems with getting them the services they need?
Oh, absolutely, and that's a great question. So part of what we're doing with this new hearing office, we're also using in field offices generally. So we use an increasing amount of video, so that people don't have to travel a long distance to a hearing site or even a remote video hearing site, because fairly shortly you'll be able to do these hearings even from your attorney's office. And so the video has been great. The quality of the video is better and better. But we're also using this for claims taking and replacement Social Security cards. Increasingly, we had a pilot in North Dakota 3 years ago when I first started. That's been successful taking claims from reservations. And I actually had a demonstration yesterday in our field office here where they went through a mock-up of how they're taking Social Security replacement card applications from Kodiak Island by video. So I think that the wave of the future, particularly in states like Alaska, is to offer more and more through video. So we don't have it right yet. We're still – the equipment's changing very quickly. We have to balance out privacy and other concerns. We're kind of working through it. But one of the things that undoubtedly you'll see in the next 3 to 5 years from us here in Alaska is a lot more opportunity to get service through video if that's what you want.
Mm-hmm. That's what appeals to people
in
Alaska.
Good. Good.
Well, you can go to the doctor over the internet now.
Sure.
Go to class, go to college. So what's going on now? What's the future of Social Security? I keep hearing, 26 million baby boomers will be applying for Social Security in the next year or two, and then 54 million after that, and these astronomical numbers. I mean, is there enough money to go around?
Yeah. So there's some cause for concern, but not cause for panic. So one of the key things to understand if you're worried about Social Security is that when you hear the word insolvency, it doesn't mean the same thing as if I were insolvent or you were insolvent. It would mean basically we're out of money. For us, it's a technical term that means that we don't have enough money in the trust funds to pay the historic full benefit. So what happens under the statute is you pay as much as you can with the money that you have. So when we say that it's insolvent in 2037, which was the number at the last trustees report, and there'll be a new trustees report probably in April. What that means right now is that going forward, if nothing else were done to fix it, that people would get about 75% of the current benefit. Now, that's not a good outcome, but it's also not nothing. And it should give younger people that are concerned about this, there's a big difference between getting 3/4 of what people getting now and getting nothing. So we do need to make some changes to fix that issue. Congress is having trouble getting its arms around it. The president is trying to get more and more attention on entitlement reform and deficit and look at all these things as part of a package. It's probably going to be long, slow, and difficult, but, I've taken on a lot of tough jobs. I'm an optimist at heart. I do think that in the next 2 to 5 years, Congress will step up to the job and will at least substantially, maybe not fully, but substantially fix the current issues.
Wow. So all of this, I have my original Social Security card that I've had since 16, and I still have it. And like you're saying, replacement cards through video. Wow. But where did all this money get invested? The money that all of us who have worked our whole lives have paid into the system?
It really only goes to one place. It goes to Treasury bonds. It goes to what's been widely considered the safest investment you could possibly have. And sometimes there's criticism of that because the return is lower than other investments. But I think that generally the feeling in the public and the Congress has been that they don't want to take additional risk, that they want to just stick with the investment in Treasuries. I'm sure that assumption will get tested again as we have discussions about solvency. I would be surprised if there were any major shift, though, from that tradition.
Mm-hmm. Sure, since 2008, maybe they're glad that they did it that way. Mm-hmm. So, well, and the mysterious Part D,
yes,
which people make much of. I don't need it. I haven't applied for it. And you can apply for it every year for during a,
sure,
a three-month period?
Sure. So we have a relatively limited role in that. We don't make Medicare decisions, but we deliver the message because we have the network of field offices, and we've been given the responsibility of working on outreach for the Medicare Part D Extra Help program. So what's important for people to understand about Extra Help, there are a lot of low-income people out there who are struggling to pay for their pharmaceuticals and making a choice between their prescriptions and food and very, very hard choices, that Congress this last year did simplify the program and expand eligibility. So if you've been rejected in the past, you shouldn't automatically assume that you'll be rejected this time around. We would encourage people who are anywhere close to the standards, which are very complex, but basically, if you're making under $25,000 a year, there are asset rules and other things. I would say just come in, do the application, find out, and take a crack at it, because it's almost $4,000 in benefits for people that have high drug costs. And that's something that in this economy could make a huge difference for a lot of people who are suffering.
Where does the United States stand in comparison to other countries in taking care of its older people no longer in the workforce?
Sure. We're right up at the top. You know, it depends a little bit on what you value. There are other countries where the health care for older Americans is more comprehensive and less expensive. But in terms of pension and benefit and other support, we're right up there at the high end. We have in our international role, we do coordination agreements with other countries that have systems that, by statute, we consider comparable. And there aren't really very many. There are about 25 in the world that are somewhere in the same zone that we are. And most of those aren't quite as generous as ours. So if you look around the world as a senior citizen, there aren't a lot of countries that are even treating you as well as you're treated here in the United States.
A lot of us are thinking of retiring like in another country, because what the Social Security would bring to me, I could live on anything, but I could live a lot better, say, in Mexico or
right.
Belize.
It wouldn't change your benefit. And there are an increasing number of Americans that are going to other countries in their retirement. We're doing a lot of business recently, for instance, in Panama. The real benefit is for people who do that is the cost of living. Sometimes it's a lot cheaper to live abroad. But your benefit, your retirement benefits earned, and whether you live in Costa Rica or Bakersfield, California or Mongolia, will send you the same check regardless of where you choose to live.
Are they taxed, the retirement benefits?
Yes, they are taxed over a certain limit at a certain percent, and it does get complicated. But yes, it is taxed. The only benefits that you can't take out of the country, we do have the welfare part of the program, SSI, and you can't leave the country and collect SSI. But if you've earned under the insurance program, that's an entitlement, and you can take that wherever you want to live.
Wow. Okay, that's all I'm going to ask. Is there something you'd like to add that we haven't talked about?
No, I would just remind people that, you know, the portal to a lot of services and a lot of our information is socialsecurity.gov. It's a very easy to navigate website. And even if you yourself are not close to some decision that relates to us, statistically, you almost have to have a relative or dear friend who is. And a lot of times those people need help. So I would encourage pretty much everybody at some point when you're surfing the web to check out our website, socialsecurity.gov.
That was Social Security Commissioner Michael Astru talking to KSKA's Ellen Lockyer. Commissioner Astru says about 1,200 Alaskans a year file appeals on disability benefit decisions. You've been listening to A Closer Look, a special KSKA program that takes an in-depth look at the people and issues that affect our community. An archived copy of A Closer Look will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. Thanks for listening to KSKA Anchorage.